Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So it was 1 year ago today, just before lunchtime, when the New York Times posted a story on their website that revealed then-Governor Eliot Spitzer was involved in a high-priced prostitution ring. By dinner time, Governor Spitzer was apologizing to his wife and to the state and to the nation, even though he didn't resign right away. We all know what happened after that. These days, Eliot Spitzer is a columnist for Slate, believe it or not. His favorite call girl is now a celebrity, believe it or not, while the proprietors of the Emperor's Club VIP escort service have served time in jail. We thought we would take this occasion to see what we've learned about the law and the enforcement of prostitution more broadly 1 year after the headlines and late-night comedy routines. Patricia Pileggi is a partner at the law firm Schiff Hardin. She has worked both sides of this issue. She's defended an alleged madam, and before that was a federal prosecutor, serving as the chief of the Public Integrity Unit of the Eastern District of New York. Patricia Pileggi, welcome to WNYC. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me.
Why didn't Eliot Spitzer serve jail time if other people involved in this did?
For one thing, he was never charged. The U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District evidently decided to exercise their discretion and not charge him with a criminal offense.
Why not?
You see this all the time. Not every criminal offense is charged. Prosecutors exercise their discretion all the time. You have very often narcotics offenses. There are very many narcotics offenses that could be charged by the federal authorities that are not, because they make decisions day in and day out about how to allocate their resources, as well as whether or not, in the prosecutor's view, the need for additional punishment is necessary.
Now, the way you put it makes it sound like it was kind of a special favor, this discretion, toward somebody who was rich and powerful, or rich and formerly powerful, like Eliot Spitzer. But wasn't it really the opposite, that because other Johns are not prosecuted, that it would have been a matter of singling him out for special punishment if he was actually brought into court for this?
I think you're exactly right. I think that if he was charged, it would have been very different than the way the clients of prostitutes or the Johns are treated day in and day out. They are very rarely, if ever, charged. And so it would have been a very different position for the U.S. Attorney's Office to make a decision to charge him.
So if the crime itself is considered so minor, what about the others who did serve time? The boss of Emperor's Club VIP, Mark Brenner, pleaded guilty to two conspiracy counts involving prostitution and money laundering, presumably because prosecutors were leaning hard on him. He's serving 2.5 years. So why would they go after him for essentially the same thing, just another aspect of setting it up?
I think that what prosecutors make decisions about is how do you best achieve deterrence. Do you achieve deterrence by going after the organization that's promoting a particular kind of conduct, or do you go after the customers, or both? In this instance, I think they made a decision to go after the organization that was promoting the conduct.
Can shame be used as a more effective policing and prevention tool than prosecution, maybe for a certain kind of John?
I think that an argument can be made that if you do want to achieve real deterrence, you do both ends. You both charge the organization and you charge the individuals who are using the services of prostitutes. A while back, federal and state authorities were doing that in connection with narcotics offenses, where they were not only going after organizations, they were actually seizing cars of individuals who were purchasing drugs. So I think that an argument can be made that you could charge both the customer as well as the organization in order to achieve even greater deterrence.
There's a famous moment in in the history of this radio station, WNYC, from before I was here. But Ed Koch was mayor, and he wanted to institute a program on the station, which was then owned by the city, called the John Hour, where somebody was supposed to go on and read the names of Johns who were arrested for prostitution in New York City. And it was such a big deal here. The president of the station at the time resigned, and there was only one John Hour, and then Mayor Koch pulled it. Think something like that could have been effective?
I think that's actually very problematic because when somebody's arrested, they've just been charged with a crime. They haven't been convicted of anything at that point. And there is always the chance that somebody has been wrongly accused. There are acquittals all the time. So having a John Hour based simply on the fact of an arrest, I think, would be fairly problematic.
Several ex-call girls, especially the high-priced ones, are getting rich on tell-all books. Then the police come after the author, demanding a client list. Does the law compel a sex worker to name names?
If a subpoena was issued during the course of an investigation of a prostitution ring for records, for business records, then that organization would be required to turn over records. If a subpoena was issued to individuals for testimony, they may or may not have to testify, depending on whether or not they decided to exercise their Fifth Amendment rights.
And from a post yesterday on the Daily Beast website, a madam in her 70s was quoted as saying, "If the police start arresting clients, we don't have customers anymore. They will be so afraid they'll stop. I want them to believe that they'll be left alone so they'll continue spending money." So presumably the police have tried this before. Why doesn't it happen?
I think that's a very good question. I mean, I think that if there was a real attempt at arresting customers, that you would have customers who would be fearful of using the services of prostitutes. I think that these organizations are easily replaced, and a very, very effective way of deterring the clients of prostitutes would be to arrest and actually pursue them.
Why do you think there is such outrage over cases like Bernie Madoff, as we were talking about before, and Elliot Spitzer? I mean, considering that there are worse things in the world, certainly worse things in the world than what Spitzer did, and Bernie Madoff's crime is unbelievably heinous, and it's really, you know, destroyed a lot of people's ordinary families' financial lives, but people are comparing him to Hitler without any compunction. Probably over the top. And when we did our first segment on the show a year ago tomorrow about the Elliot Spitzer case, we got more comments on our comments page than we've ever gotten about any other segment, over 400. Why do you think this gets people like that?
In terms of Spitzer, I think that people expect much more of their governor. I think that they were simply horrified to see somebody that they respect behaving in such a way. And then on top of that, he was someone who was extremely aggressive in law enforcement. So he really did have a very law and order image. And for someone who's the governor and who has this law and order platform to be then arrested on charges or implicated in prostitution was, I think, extremely understandably upsetting to people.
So Chris in Park Slope wants to revisit this in a different way. Hi, Chris.
Hey, good morning, Brian and guest.
So what do you think?
I'm just thinking, you know, I think I was amazed when Spitzer resigned because, I mean, you know, David Vitter, the famous diaper senator, kept his job. It just seems like for Elliot Spitzer to resign over what I imagine is fairly common practice just seemed to me to be the wrong move. I don't know. I mean, it's wrong to, you know, pay women for sex, I suppose, but it just seems like all of a sudden, you know, the standard for what's acceptable became really narrow, and Spitzer somehow fell afoul of that. And then, I don't know. I just think he should have, you know, hung in there.
Chris, thank you very much. And Pat, I mean, a lot of this does come down to politics rather than law in terms of what happens to the individual politician. For whatever reason, David Vitter was able to skate by with what he did. Eliot Spitzer, who had made a lot of enemies, was not. He was also, putting himself out there as a purveyor of public integrity and going harder after prostitution rings as governor and previously as attorney general. So he had less of a leg to stand on maybe than some others. But the real crime, I mean, where I recall that there was the legal-oriented pressure wasn't even so much around the prostitution itself. It was the way he moved money around to hide it. Do you think that was, I mean, that's where people thought that if there was going to be a legal action against Spitzer, that it would come, no?
I think that he was vulnerable on two fronts. One was for a Mann Act prosecution, which is the interstate transportation of an individual for immoral purposes. And then the other, he did have vulnerability in terms of money laundering, in that he was conducting transactions in a manner that was designed to conceal the existence of an illegal organization.
Now, that's not prostitution. Why wasn't he prosecuted for that?
I think that the U.S. Attorney's Office exercised its discretion in deciding whether or not to charge him.
Was his resignation a de facto plea agreement?
I think that his resignation was probably a very important factor in making a decision not to charge him.
Last thing, what would you say the impact of the Spitzer case has been, now that it's been 1 year to the day, on prostitution or prostitution law in New York? Anything?
In terms of whether or not there is less prostitution, I would doubt that there's been any impact. I don't see consistent enough enforcement of either organizations or individuals. And I don't mean to criticize that exercise of discretion. There are not limitless resources in state or federal prosecutors' offices, and they've got to make decisions about whether or not to devote resources to individuals like Bernie Madoff, who stole billions of dollars, as opposed to individuals who are engaging in what may be consensual behavior.
And so, in that light, and last question before you go, and as somebody who has been a defender of people in these crimes and somebody who's been a prosecutor in the public integrity unit, why not decriminalize prostitution altogether? Is it because women should be seen as victims in the eyes of the law, or for some other reason, or would you support a decriminalization of this consensual act?
I think that's a complicated question. One concern about the decriminalization of prostitution is there is an aspect of prostitution which is horrible, and that is there are organizations who do use underage girls, who use violence to keep the prostitutes under control, and I think that you want to be very careful that you are not legitimizing those types of organizations as well.
Right. So the whole question of consensual is really not as clear-cut as all that. All right. She has defended an alleged madam, and before that was a federal prosecutor serving as the chief of the Public Integrity Unit of the Eastern District of New York. She is Patricia Pileggi, now a partner at the law firm Schiff Hardin, talking about the legal issues 1 year later. It was 1 year ago today that Eliot Spitzer's behavior was revealed. Pat, thanks a lot for coming on with us.
Thank you very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, we're going to talk to the Takeaways culture critic, Mary Beth Williams. She has written a book about looking for a home in New York City during the housing bubble and now living in it afterwards. Stay with us.